Welcome to the Breaking Health Podcast, a series of discussions with the most disruptive CEOs and leaders in digital health.
Welcome to the Breaking Health Podcast. Siva Namasivayam. How are you?
Wonderful. Great weather.
Great weather now.
It's
colder in Boston than we like it. It's like 45 degrees today in Boston. So
yeah, I'm just south of you, and it seems to be nice outside.
So. Yeah, it's good to have you on. As you know, we like to talk about startups and new ideas for healthcare, and I know that this isn't your first rodeo, as they say. So you've had a lot of success as a founder and CEO of healthcare startups. So a lot of the people that listen in are starting their first company or going out and getting funded. And I always like to understand, like, you know, it's easy to get a job, right? What prompted you to start a company? We could talk about starting this one, but generally, given you're like what we call a serial entrepreneur,
yeah.
What made you become an entrepreneur when you could have just gotten a job?
You know, I started my career like everyone else in large companies like Intel and the Gartner Group. I think you get to a point in life that you feel that you want to do a lot and you are not able to accomplish that within the constraints of a large corporation. And then, it's the whole ecosystem that is available in the country, right? Which allows you to I think I can do it. And here's an idea I have. And, here is the, vexing problem. And for that matter, it could be for patient, when we talk about healthcare. But in general, there is a, vexing problem. I try to find out that nobody seems to have solved it. You know, in a large company, I understand completely the constraints and how they do it. I just have to go and do it. And, fully well knowing that it could be a success or it could be a failure. So there is a spark that happens at some point in your life that you are so frustrated that you are not able to kind of make a difference and make a change. And you just have to take a leap at that time. And if you keep on getting more conservative around it and say, maybe not, maybe all that, it's not going to work out. So I think that spark that comes some point in time when you are so frustrated that, I can do it and let me just put the right step in and get going on trying to do something on my own, but also make a difference, right? And I think that is...
That's cool.
It's very difficult to explain, but that's what it is.
Well, but by the way, I should mention that the name of the company is Cohere Health, and we'll talk about your current endeavor, but I want to keep asking you a couple more. I think what I would say, you reach some sort of a point, and people have that point that's different where you don't even think about being afraid. You just have to do it, right?
Yes. Yes. I think that's a good way of putting it. Yes, that's correct. You just have to do it otherwise, you feel you haven't accomplished anything in life, which is
right.
True, right? So, some people have that thing, and I have the same thing, is that what the heck am I doing, showing 9 to 5 or something like that and doing something, and I'm not making much difference. So
that's cool. There's a couple of different kinds of founders out there. Some founders like build the product, and then they become like a CEO because they built some prototype or something. And then there's other founders that have a vision and recognize they have to create a team to help them build the product. What type of founder are you?
I am definitely the second one.
Yeah.
But I can be dangerous on the first one.
Yeah. Well, yes. Keep that man out of the lab, right?
Yeah, that's right. Because I kind of tell my people, I can be very dangerous technically because I came out of Intel, right? Intel gave me like phenomenal stuff around technology, the basics, fundamental stuff, etc. But I know my limitations. And I also know that things in technology change so fast that if you are just out of it and doing things for 5 years, that's it. It's kind of gone.
Right.
So I am more of I know what the product should be and how the product features and stuff like that can make a difference in terms of the business model and the vision, but I leave it to the team to figure out how to get there. So I really depend on putting a great team and people and let them do that as long as we are all traveling towards the same end goal, if you will, in terms of
vision. When did you start Cohere? What year did you start it?
It's 2019.
Okay.
And compared to my previous one where I just had to do it, right? As I said, with CO Health Analytics, which was about 11 years, we got Sequoia investing in us on just a business plan, nothing more than that, and built the team. And it was very successful. After I kind of sold off, CO Health Analytics, I was thinking in that, there are quite a few problems in healthcare. And I know that, so I can go back or I can, retire and do nothing, or I can just figure out how we can actually solve a bigger problem or at least make a difference in a bigger problem that the industry is facing. If I am not able to do it, then I felt that I have not accomplished anything in life, actually. So I was just sitting and thinking that what is the problem out there that can be solved with technology? I'm still, at the end of the day, heart of heart, I am a big believer in technology. That's because of my background. And healthcare is nowhere close to how financial services and the big tech companies have utilized technology to do that. So the problem that is vexing, which I have observed very closely with some of the large health plans, if you will, which we worked with at CO Health Analytics, was around the whole UM process, utilization management. So I was thinking about it, and then I was talking to people in the market, and coincidentally, one of the large health plans was also looking at putting a, investing in a company that could actually change it. So things kind of melded, and Cohere, they already had wanted to solve the problem. Here I was, because with my previous work with analytics, and I think it was more around fraud, waste, abuse, et cetera, and population health.
Yeah.
I was trying to say, so it was a meeting of the minds. And then we said, okay, here is Cohere Health, and here is how we are going to solve the problem that is different from what is existing in the market today. Yeah. So that's how it kind of came about in 2019, I would say late 2019. And the health
plan. You've been a COVID company. You've been a virtual company, I would imagine.
That's the thing, right? Here we are. We got the office in Boston in January, like a co-work space. Had like three employees starting on around January 2nd, and managed to get our CTO, CPO hired. And it was around February, I recall, around 28th or something like that, in our building in Boston, downtown Boston on 50 Milk Street. The guy said, you know what? They have identified two COVID cases and we are going to shut down the building. That was when we came home, everybody went home and said, how are we going to operate? And we said, okay, we can't give up on our mission because we had a goal of going live on January 1, 2021. So we said, we are just going to create a company with virtual Zoom or whatever it is. Hopefully we said that maybe in another 3 months, we can all get back together, but it's very precious time. So that's how we got started. And you won't believe, by the end of 2020, just before we were ready to go live, we were 220 people around the country, majority in Boston, but we had built a team. So it was a complete COVID built team, right, around COVID.
Amazing, right?
It is amazing. And
amazing. You can even do it. Have you guys all met eventually in person?
We have met. Just to be honest, I think around September last year was the first time about 50 of us met.
Yeah.
Okay. We haven't met everyone. And we try to meet now at least once in a month or once in 2 months. Yeah. And then what happened was in December, we had a meeting, believe it or not, about 50 people. And then, boom, another spread.
Another surge. Yeah. Let's talk about UM. All right. Because I don't know that a lot of people understand UM. So can you give us sort of the blocking and tackling basics of UM and then sort of identify where you've found the disruption opportunity?
Yeah, wonderful. And, because you're, health agent,
I do, but my listeners may not know, and I'm not sure I can explain it as well as you. So I'm going to ask you.
there's a lot of mumbo over there. But if you kind of think about UM, it is a process the health plans actually use to help ensure that the members are getting good quality and safe medical care. And they also do that to ensure that they can avoid some of the unnecessary expense that have. Because we do know that there are unnecessary, if you kind of go back to Dartmouth Atlas and everything else, it is a known fact that there are unwarranted variations in quality and cost around the country. And so health plans, with respect to the fiduciary duties, but also to make sure that they can control the cost on those, it's a process that they have put together to be able to do that, right? I think that is the crux of, the UM process. However, I think it was conceived, I would say, maybe even 20 or 30 years back, because the healthcare market moved towards a managed care market where health plans were taking risk, this became a necessary tool for them to be able to control the costs. But as have other things in healthcare, what was conceived as supposed to be a good process has taken life of its own with regulations and the complexity. And today, it is like heavily manual, inefficient, and actually inadvertently, which is the most important thing that we want to focus on, is there is a care delay that has been introduced. The patient does not, the patient journey, if you really look at it as they kind of go through that, is heavily interrupted with with this process. So I think that is kind of the state of the industry. I know that technology companies, I'm pretty familiar with Altruista, they are addressing it very, very nicely with a good process, portal, et cetera. But the interesting thing that we saw was how, not just looking at just technology, but how we can actually look at it from a different perspective, saying that the process traditionally used single transactions. So if you really look at a patient as they go through, say, arthritic pain or a cardiac procedure, there are multiple services involved. It could be imaging, it could be PT, it could be like a DME, it could be something like that. But what happens is that the way that the process evolved is usually each one is considered just on its own, whether that makes sense or not. So we wanted to, the opportunity that we saw was flip the whole thing around and say that, hey, look, put the patient at the center of this process and look at what should be their ideal care pathway based on the risk, based on all the factors that they have. And how can we ensure that they are getting the right care at the right time, at the right place, without interruptions. And we are looking at the longitudinal patient journey and looking at trying to optimize that instead of trying to look at single transaction by transaction. So okay. That's the fundamental of how we have been trying to disrupt the industry.
So if I think about it, so utilization management, it's kind of like a cold word, right? Very cold.
Yeah, it is.
But the idea is I need to approval for imaging, approval for a procedure, right? It's outside the norm. There's a process to go through to get it. And all of us, regardless of how old we are, at some point in our life, got a denial from the health plan said, no, you can't do that. So that is utilization management sort of in action. The provider said, I want to send you to get an MRI. And the plan came back and said, no, that's not the right next step. You can't get an MRI. And the doctor's like, okay, maybe I need to send you for an X-ray first, or I got to send you for an ultrasound first. At the end of the day, you might land on the MRI, but the procedure that's approved is to do that. And we all are just like annoyed that we can't just get our MRI, right? We can't get what we want.
That's right.
It's a big ablation issue for providers and members.
Absolutely.
And it seems to me that there's probably procedures that should be denied or should certainly be questioned. But there are also there's also a lot of waste in the middle that can be removed.
Yes.
And I'm guessing that you'd like to use data to evaluate a request to determine, well, what's going to happen anyway, right?
Yes.
Like, we know this is where the patient is based on their medical condition. Hmm. I'm getting a request for this procedure. What do we likely see happening? And is that request reasonable based on what we're predicting would happen?
And yeah, so I think
can we authorize it? I'm guessing, but I think getting a feel for that's where you're heading.
Okay, so that's a very good segue into how we are looking at it. Right, we think of this as a pyramid where we are technology plus clinical. Okay, because we have actually a lot of MDs in the company. In fact, I think it's now over 15 to 20 MDs. And then we have intelligence, which comes from data, analytics, AI, ML, etc. So let me kind of peel the onion, right, a little bit more. Now, you kind of brought up an interesting one. Okay, MRI. When you go into, say, with the pain in your knee, you might sometimes say that, A, the physician ordered an MRI and it got denied.
Because it's expensive, right? It's expensive.
Yeah, it is, because it's expensive, right? So what happens is that in the background, traditionally what has been happening was that particular MRI request, there are things called guidelines that people have. And so what happens is that the physician makes a request to the health plan with saying that, okay, this patient has got these conditions, or when I examine them, so I want them to have MRI. So they send the request to the health plan. And the health plan typically used to look at it and say that, okay, here is a guideline for MRI. And they will go and tick it. And so they say, okay, these are there. And by the way, they might say that these things are not fulfilled, so I'm going to deny. But what is lost in that, just looking at a context of this, is that that particular patient, the health plan is sitting on data as to what happened to the patient previously and what happened to similar cohort of patients previously. And so you are not contextual, you might find it hard to believe, but the context of a patient is usually lost because it has become like a manual transaction, right? So what we have tried to do is that, okay, there are guidelines that the physician societies have, which says that, hey, if you are over, say, 60 years old, you have got these four risk factors or five risk factors, and this pain has been long-lasting, 6 months, and you have gone through PT, etc., and it is not working, and then what should you do? That is an ideal like situation for an MRI, right? But sometimes this information is not presented because the patient is not giving it or the documentation is not correct, etc. But now, if I am able to get a longitudinal view of the patient, I can see that patients of similar type, and by the way, we do know this patient went for a physical visit before. So I don't even want to ask any questions saying that the patient has already gone through all these conservative treatments and things that they need to do. Let's kind of get them the MRI. But also what we tell them is that after MRI, what's going to happen? It could be pain injections and things like that. So we want to be able to approve the entire episode at that point without asking too many questions because we are sitting on a lot of data. And these care pathways are things that are endorsed by the physicians because there are about 30 or 40 care pathways, for example, just in knee and the hip and the spine. That's based on a specific type of a patient and the cohort. So we have digitized it. So we find out where the patient is in that journey, and we look at the history, and we say that the societies have actually endorsed this is a type of a care pathway. As long as the patient is on the care pathway, just approve. Don't kind of ask too many questions and back and forth and things like that, right? So that is the gist of what we are trying to do, so that the patient is continuing on the journey, and if they're not punted back to PT or they're not punted back to something else, pain, etc. And in some cases, we determine that, hey, this patient is so severe that send them to surgery. Yes, they should have surgery. Don't waste time on all these other things because those things are not going to work. So I think that's what we are really trying to do, is to make the patient experience really good and the patient is getting the right care. Then the final aspect of this also, there is also place of service involved, which is where there are now various nuances in healthcare, right, around the site where you perform this. It could be a site where, hey, do you want to do that in an inpatient setting? It's going to cost the patient something like $2,000 out of pocket. But if the same service with the same quality by the same surgeon is performed in an ASC, it could be like no cost to the patient. So what we are trying to do is that we are actually telling the physician that the patient, unfortunately, has to bear this cost. So we are surfacing that information to the patient also. So we are trying to influence the patient, the provider, to say that now when you take a patient and their financial situation, but also this is the right thing for you to do, then the physician can actually make the right decision in terms of the next step, where surgery is done, and what is the best thing for the patient. So we are surfacing that information to the physician so that they can also make the right decision, taking the patient into context.
Where do you come in to the picture? Do you come into the picture, Cohere, when the authorization is submitted by the physician? So when,
yes, absolutely,
goes on to the portal, submits for an auth.
Yeah.
Then you run a series of algorithms, I'm assuming.
Yeah, immediately.
Do most of the auths get approved automatically, or do they have to go?
Yes. As long as that's what our simple philosophy is, that, hey, as long as the physician is doing the right thing based on all the care pathways, and the patient is actually getting the right thing, and there is no such, just that, like our philosophy is that physicians know the best, give the benefit of doubt to them, and we will approve that as long as these conditions are met. Only when there is a variation, we try to really get involved. But even when we try to involve, we try to use softer techniques, like, you know, we use something called nudging on the platform to say that, you know, what looks like the patient has already kind of gone through this, or the patient hasn't gone through treatment like physical therapy or something like that. It looks like this surgery, based on certain guidelines might not get approved, by the way, because the patient has not gone through these things. Are you sure? Then what happens is that they say that maybe that is true because, you know, we need to go back and look at it, and maybe they might actually change their decision at the point of care itself. So they don't even have to submit an authorization. They might, instead of submitting an authorization for a surgery, you know what? It's probably best practice to go back and send them to a pain physician or to a, you know, just get them about 6 to 10 sessions of PT and see how they can improve, etc. So we use a technique called nudging that, can you do the right thing? And, you know, this is based on the data. This is what it tells them. And what we find out is that more often than not, the physician and their office is able to kind of take that information. Because we are actually in a world, what we are finding at the end of the day is that there is, you know, the missing information or there is a lot of, you know, information that is not available at the point of care to the physician to be able to make the right decision. So the more and more we give them, the more and more we nudge them, they will kind of get towards the right decision. So that's what we are trying to do at the point of care.
That's great. So so how is it going? How are the health? I'm assuming you're using claims data and lab and pharmacy data as your principal inputs.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, actually we do. And then we are actually starting looking at imaging data because at the end of the day, what you find out is that a physician, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise to people that diagnostic imaging that you do first, pretty much if it is done, if the reading is done correctly, if it's a high quality image, and if the reading is done, interpreted correctly, it can actually potentially reduce like all the lot of the waste because there is like, you know, I have heard a statistic that there is like 20% of the images are not, are poor quality and are actually misread. And so what happens is that if we can actually do that part very well, so we are getting that information also, and that's where AI, ML, we are partnering with people. We are not doing it ourselves because this is a, that itself is a very complex area. But that's where AI and ML can give one, can give assistance to the radiologist to improve the reading part of it. Once that is done, the diagnosis, once the diagnosis is correct, then the treatment pathways are fairly, I would say that, you know, there are probably like 2 or 3 decisions what the physician need to make, and they will be able to do that. So imaging is another important area that we are focused on from a, you know, from a signal perspective.
And who are you focused on as your customer, the health plans?
Health plans and risk-bearing providers.
Yeah. So how are they responding when you, I'm assuming that you've been talking to a lot, to them a lot. How, what do they think?
Okay. So our we are right now at 5.5 million members in the country.
Wow.
We are available in over 100,000 physician offices. The interesting statistics, I will kind of think, I will tell you one, you know, this, like a couple of statistics that we have. We, about... 95% of the authorizations are now done through, meaning, you know, of the total volume that we are responsible for, 95% comes through the web, the application that we have. And because that is a very important thing that we look for, because only when it is digital, we are able to use intelligence, clinical intelligence, to be able to do something with them. That is like a very high bar that we are setting in the industry compared to what we have heard from our clients. You know, so, and we have been able to get that pretty fast because of the way that we design the app and the user research and all of that. The second interesting thing is that something like 88 to 90% of, say, a particular area like musculoskeletal or cardiology, we are able to approve, pretty much auto-approve that. That's because we are able to nudge them, we are able to change things, etc. And about 10% goes to the clinicians to review. And we are really trying to get that closer to 92 to 93%. Because that's what is happening in the real world, is that while there is all these authorizations that are getting submitted, what you find out is something like 96, 97% of them are approved eventually. Okay. So the whole idea is that, okay, how can you just automate that 96, 97%? I think that's our vision and goal. We believe that over the next 3 years, we will be able to achieve it with all the technology. What that means is only like 3 to 4% is going to go to the clinicians to review, and about 95 to 96% of the decisions can be made. And that is a statistic that I watch every day to make sure that we are getting more and more things through with auto approval. Then the other important thing is that the provider abrasion, which is very important, and the provider experience is there. We have actually 91%, we do these surveys often, 91% of the practices that users are highly satisfied. So when we really look at, okay, what is the 9%? What are they trying? Why are they not happy? It's more because they are frustrated with the prior, you know, as you said, it's a cold world. They are just like frustrated with the process, not because of what, how we have tried to simplify it. What we are trying to do is to simplify a process that unfortunately has to happen. And we are trying to do our best to make that better, right? And the other important thing that we get from our clients is we are able to do at least 10 to 15%, provide them savings on the medical expense side compared to what we are, what they are doing today manually or through some other legacy process. That is important because the way that we are doing care pathways, really, it actually takes care of the efficiency too automatically. So that is reducing their MedEx by about 15% or so, which is like a powerful one. So it's almost too good to be true, but providers are satisfied. The patients are actually, you know, also the providers indicated to us, at least we are able to cut about 4 to 5 days in terms of the care delays for the patients. So patients are getting, there is less delay. The providers are happier, you know, and the payers are actually getting a lot more than what they used to get. So it is an optimal equation that we are trying to get, which satisfies all three parties to an extent. And I think that we are fairly successful with that. So we are right now actually 4 clients, and we continue to add more and more. And we continue to add more and more specialties and areas to what we do. So I would say that we have gone through a very fast growth cycle over the last, 18 months. And it just is unabated at this point.
That's terrific. I love talking to you. It was a lot of fun having you on the show. And the business is going well. I love to see that happening. It's a lot of fun to grow, a lot of fun to make a difference, right?
Yes. Definitely. And Abe, we should definitely talk because I have a lot of respect for the platform. And actually, we love to work together, actually. Yeah. And because I think Altruist is adding a very, very important thing. And we actually try to collaborate and not compete, right, with any of those things. I think that is the most important because we focus a lot more on the clinical side. So
we'll get together, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure. So give the audience a chance to understand. Where can they find out about you? Twitter, Facebook? On the website, where are you guys?
It is www.coherehealth.com. LinkedIn, we are pretty active in LinkedIn. You know, we put all our thought process and things like that. We have webinars coming up, quite a bit of webinars. It's all, you can go to the website or LinkedIn. We are on Twitter. Facebook, not so much, for our audience anyway. So I think that we are very active in that. And I think Twitter, LinkedIn, website, there are very high quality webinars with the guests that are coming up. people can register for that on the site or actually, you know, through LinkedIn. So
that's at coherehealth.com.
Yes. Right?
That's where you're at. Yes. Hey, great to meet you. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Wonderful. Thanks, Steve. Take care. Have a great day.